Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Getting It Done with your host, Dr. Walter Dean. Today is a moral day. It's Memorial Day, huh? This is the time when we give honor to those who fought for our country. So, you will be listening to William Overton, 2017, who was at that time considered to be the oldest living veteran from the Second World War. Can't you believe that? His birthday. Wow, let's listen up.
Nation's oldest veteran who lives right here in Austin turns 111 years old today.
And as usual, his birthday is a major event. Fox 7's Casey Claiborne spent the day with Richard Overton and has a recap of his big day.
Rain or shine, when Richard Overton has a birthday, he does big. This is true block party style here in East Austin. People from the neighborhood here, family, friends, veterans, all standing in line, waiting to spend a little bit of time with Mr. Overton, get a picture with him, talk to him, give him a gift. And today's birthday is extra special because the street that he's lived on for a long time is getting an honorary name, Richard Overton Avenue. For Richard Overton, the nation's oldest veteran, the celebration of his 111th year on this earth started at the University of Texas Club, a luncheon in his honor.
How you doing today?
I'm doing all right.
All right, because it's your birthday?
Yeah. Overton, an Army veteran, served in Hawaii in the South Pacific during World War II. He built a house in East Austin in 1945, and he's been there ever since. And at 111, he's as sharp as a tack.
I feel well.
Overton's birthday this year is an even bigger deal than the last. The Austin City Council has to give the street he's lived on for more than 70 years an honorary name, Richard Overton Avenue.
I have already received photos of you with the sign and under the sign.
Overton's life since being named the oldest veteran has been a whirlwind. Former Governor Rick Perry paid him a visit on his front porch.
Honored to meet you, sir.
Honored to meet you.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to come by and visit with you.
He was honored in Washington, D.C. one year for Veterans Day by President Obama himself.
His service on the battlefield was not always matched by the respect that he deserved at home, but this veteran held his head high.
Honor Flight Chairman Alan Bergeron sat next to Overton during the luncheon and sang his praises.
We're going to get the big statue of Mr. Richard Overton and put you in a museum.
This last year, he quit driving, so he was driving at 110. Very sharp. He's very aware of his surroundings. And, everyone always asks, how do you do it? What's your secret? And he always says God. He's a very spiritual man.
But Overton also gives a little credit to cigars.
How many cigars have you had this morning?
And whiskey, even though his opinion on the spirit seems to change a little bit every time we chat with him.
Oh, I used to drink whiskey a long time ago. I always drink a little bit. That kept me alive. I've been living so long. Whiskey hit you. The same as medicine. You take it right.
The Fox 7 crew brought him a bottle of Maker's Mark, Caremaker's favorite. Many of his other guests had the same idea.
How you doing, sir? All right. Good to see you. I know everybody's been getting you a bottle of whiskey. What are you going to do with all these bottles of whiskey?
Throw them out of the yard.
Throw them out of the yard. Well, what are the flowers with it?
And as for being the nation's oldest veteran, Richard Overton is grateful and looking forward to 112.
I ain't getting rich, but I feel glad.
What can I say? We love this guy. Always love talking to him. From all of us here at Fox 7, happy birthday to Mr. Richard Overton.
Well, first I just thought that they were freckles. Very unattractive blob things on my face.
Okay. That's called being slow on the draw because I was planning on cutting that particular thing off. That was a short story about a gentleman who lived to be, actually he died last year. And that was something that was taped back in 2017. And so he passed on in 2019 at the ripe old age of, believe it or not, 113 years old. Last living veteran for Memorial Day, Richard Overton. Now, we're going to go on, and the rest of the shows are going to be about some of the things that we've been talking about. The first one is going to be an ex-slave that talked about slavery in the United States. Now, you know, this is really interesting because slavery was over in 1863. That's when the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. However, it didn't go into effect until 1864, in January of 1864. However, there were people who lived up to the time where there were recordings and people interviewed them. So let's give a listen to one slave right here talking about what took place.
John Henry Falk may have experienced the most profound effect. He was a graduate student when he interviewed the former slaves, including the two women you hear in this broadcast. Himself interviewed just before he died in 1979, Falk was going on about how he believed in giving blacks the right to go to school, giving them the right to vote, giving them the right to go into anything they qualified for. And then he said he experienced an epiphany.
I'm sitting out on a wagon tongue for so black men, and was telling him what a different kind of white man I was. I remember him looking at me very sadly and kind of sweetly and condescending. So, you know, you've got the disease, honey. I know you think you're cured, but you're not cured. You can't give me the right to be a human being. I'm born with that right. Now, you can keep me from having that. If you've got all the policemen and all the jobs on your side, you can deprive me of it. But you can't give it to me. Because I'm born with it just like you was. My God, it had a profound effect on me. I was furious with him. But the more I reflect on it, the more profoundly it affected me. I realized this was where it really was.
Tell you the truth, when I think of it today, I don't know how I am living.
I remember that book was well, look like to me, I think.
We've seen all our lives, mother was slave, sister was slave, father was slave.
But you know, I'm not living like that. All the dialogue that teaches the mind lost me in this book. None of them didn't let go. See, at the funeral, this turned just like he turned to a mountain and didn't let go.
They are haunting voices from the past, not actors reading a script or scholars reading a text, but the actual voices of men and women, Americans, who were born in slavery.
My name is Houghton Hughes. I was born in Charlottesville, Virginia. My grandfather belonged to Thomas Jefferson. My grandfather was 115 years old when he died. And now I am 101 years old.
Thank you didn't have no babies in their seas. You know, simple and poor. Tired of you, just like a lot of wild people. We didn't know nothing. Didn't I look in your book?
Harriet Smith, remembering what she saw as a small girl during the final days of the Civil War.
He's been arrested on that ticket list. All the long things they told him to bring back. The same thing, different things. Come to me. Come to me. Then go.
These recorded memories were among thousands of interviews done with ex-slaves in the 1930s and 40s.
Did you remember slavery days,
Brother? Of course, I remember all our white folks. All the names, all the children, call everyone the children's name.
Who did you belong?
The results of these digitally enhanced recordings are arresting, almost unbelievable. The idea of hearing the voices of actual slaves from the plantations of the Old South is as powerful, as startling, really, as if you could hear Abraham Lincoln or Robert E. Lee speak. Listen again to Fountain Hughes, who was born in 1848.
We were slaves. We belonged to people. They sell us like they sell horses and fowls and hogs and all like that. Have an auction bench. And they put you
up on the bench and beat on you the same as you're getting on a cat, you know?
Much of what these three former slaves say may at first seem unremarkable. Much of what they say may surprise and upset, and their calm demeanor is at odds with the evil and violence we associate with slavery. Here is 91-year-old Texan Laura Smalley talking in the 1940s about the outcome of a tussle between two women, one black, one white, one slave, one mistress. The mistress tried to slap the slave, but the black woman pushed her into a chair. Laura Smalley was a girl at the time, but she remembers vividly what happened to the black woman when the master came home.
Just tired of hearing this way and around the teacher of the truth. I remember that just as well. Look like to me, I can. And now the truth and hooked up. You know, she couldn't remember. Just keep her feature in. Just keep her feet. But it just had a closed back down to a ratio. It didn't have a turn with it, but it had a closed down to a race. And every now and then they put her, you know, and snuffed the pipe out on you know, snuffed the pipe out on you. We didn't want him to see the pipe, but we didn't see the pipe smoke
blowing out on
him.
The plantation on which Smalley was a slave sounds brutal. She recalls scrambling with other children for food from a huge wooden tray, like a hog trough.
All of them, you know, would get around that tray and squeeze and eat super like rice or soup or something like that. So all of them children get around there and just eat.
Fountain Hughes tells his interviewer about the relentless round of work for him on a Virginia plantation. It was cotton, not tobacco, that solidified slavery, though. The invention of the cotton gin at the end of the 18th century made its processing easy, but the crop still needed enormous amounts of unskilled labor. Control of the slave and his labor through laws and regulations became paramount. Fountain Hughes talks about one of those controls, the pass system.
Now, I couldn't go from here across the street, or I couldn't go from nobody's house without having a note or something from my master. And if I had that pass, I would really call it pass. If I had that pass, I could go wherever he sent me, and I'd have to be back, you know, when I you know where he sent me. So they'd give me another pass, and I'd be let back, so it's a show how long.
Even emancipation didn't truly free the slaves. Freedom freed slaves from more travail. The end of the Civil War found many cast adrift without skills and no place to go. And the Yankees who freed them weren't always seen as benevolent liberators.
I remember when the Yankees came along and took all the good horses and took all the sort of meat and flour and sugar and stuff. Out in the river, and they go down the river. And the more the people don't have nothing to live on, but they don't have them.
The ex-slaves left one hell for another, perhaps an even more dangerous one. No longer property, they didn't have the protections afforded property.
When you were slaves, you couldn't do that, see? Mm-hmm. And once you got free, you didn't know nothing to do. And my mother, she hunted places and bound yourself for about a month, but we didn't have no property, we didn't have no home, we had no nothing, we didn't have nothing, and I guess to let you cattle, we just turned them and get along and missed the court.
In Texas, the slaves weren't told they were free until 2 months after the war ended. Smalley remembers that her masters gave the slaves a dinner, and then they were free.
I don't know how the other side is fortunately free. We didn't know. We just thought, you know, we just knew this, you know. And we didn't know where to go. See, after shooting, just turned, just like he turned some out, you know. We didn't know where to go. That's where we stayed.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know where to go. Turns out, just like, you know, we turn out here.
In the narratives, the slaves used an interesting phrase for the end of slavery. They say, when the break came. Good times, easy times were not at hand. The trials for millions of black Americans didn't end in 1865. They continued. Laura Smalley and her family became sharecroppers. Harriet Smith's first husband was killed by whites during the Reconstruction, probably because of his political organizing. Fountain Hughes went north to Baltimore and worked at numerous jobs, including hauling manure. Not an enviable job, but it was the job of a free man. But John Henry Falk may have experienced the most profound effect.
That was a brief 9-minute presentation about where actually we were able to hear how the slaves talked. These were slaves who were from Alabama, Mississippi, and Virginia, and North Carolina, and Texas, that were part of this presentation. So now what I'm going to do, based on the time, I just want to make sure we have enough time to do it. I want to move on. We got about maybe just enough time to get this done, but I want it's a documentary that I want to do on the Buffalo Soldiers. So what's going to happen is that when I click it on, for us to hear about the Buffalo Soldiers, for those of you who do not know who the Buffalo Soldiers were, you might find it extremely interesting. Let me talk
to you. Henry Falk may have experienced them.
The Buffalo Soldiers were the soldiers that were in the infantry during the Spanish and American War. Very interesting group. After the Civil War was all over, those who were not killed wanted to stay into the service. We're going to find out something about these particular Buffalo Soldiers. And so what's going to have to happen first is us getting out of these commercials, and let's go on. You'll hear me connect you on to that particular component.
Didn't really understand what the benefits would be, but I think.
Okay, we're on now.
Now begins a story of heroism and devotion to duty that you were never taught in school. It begins and ends here at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, with the dedication of this monument to a name that stirs a faint sense of recognition, a slight jarring in some remote corner of the mind. The story of a faithful band of brothers who gloried in the name given to them by the very enemies they fought, the Buffalo Soldiers. Thousands from across the country make the pilgrimage to Kansas to hear an address by the man whose dream sparked this dedication more than 10 years ago.
General Colin Powell, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
America's highest-ranking officer, here to honor a group of men that no one knows. Nameless, faceless ghosts from the mists of frontier history. Until now. During the Civil War, they were called the U.S. Colored Troops. Nearly 180,000 fought for the Union. 33,000 died. Thousands more fought for the South. But now the war was over. Many drifted west to become farmers, cowboys, settlers. In 1866, the new Standing Army announced some startling additions. 2 regiments of cavalry, 2 of infantry, all black troops with white officers.
For most of those guys, it was a dream come true. No more cotton fields, no more factories. 13 hard cash dollars every month. Regular meals, a uniform, a chance to be somebody. Pushed into a dark corner of our past, exactly 100 years went by before their story was told. In 1967, Dr. William Leckie wrote the first and still the definitive history of the 9th and 10th Cavalry, the Buffalo Soldiers.
One thing that I don't believe many people realize, that we only had 10 regiments of cavalry. Two of those regiments were black. That's 20%. That's one cavalry in five is black. They spent from 1867 to 1891 in efforts to bring peace and order on a frontier that stretched from the Canadian border to the Mexican border, from the Rocky Mountains to the Prairie Plains. And they were the principal participants in a huge, huge, huge area. The tragedy is they never got any credit for it.
As the glamour outfits, the cavalry took the forefront. Two of the Army's best officers were assigned to command. Colonel Edward Hatch, the 9th Cavalry, and Colonel Benjamin Grierson took the job of organizing the 10th Regiment. The problems were many. Untrained, mostly illiterate ex-slaves, and no officers to train them. Assignment to a black unit was not perceived as a career-enhancing move.
The troopers knew it, too. Here's an ad in the Army-Navy Journal. A first lieutenant of infantry stationed at a very desirable post desires a transfer with an officer of the same grade on equal terms if in a white regiment. But if in a colored regiment, a reasonable bonus would be expected. Even General Custer said, no thanks. I don't want to serve with no brunettes. That's what he called us, brunettes. We've been called worse.
But the Great Plains were under siege. Comanches, Kiowa, Cheyenne, Sioux, and Arapaho warriors struck all across Kansas and Indian Territory. In the summer of 1867, Colonel Grierson and his raw recruits of the 10th Cavalry rode into battle. Their job? To protect workers building the Kansas Pacific Railroad. The first public mention of these new troops in combat came in the September 7, 1867 issue of Harper's Weekly, dateline Fort Harker, Kansas. Quote, a few months since, you could not have convinced a ranchman that there was any fight in the colored troops. It is different now. I've not met a single frontiersman who has seen the dusky patriots go for the Indians, but be loud in their praise. Why, quoth one of them the other day, plague my cats if they don't like it. After this first successful fight, the sergeant in charge turned in this report.
Me and the boys, we done all bully, except Corporal Johnson. He flinked. And the way he flinked was to stay back till we had run the engines about 2 miles. Then he come hollering, get at him, get at him. Now, me and the boys don't think nobody that flinked like that ought to have no corporal stripes.
The tradition of pride in the regiment and themselves had taken root. The troopers also took great pride in their new nickname. For its origin, we return to Dr. Leckie.
The Cheyennes saw a resemblance between the inherited black trooper and the Buffalo. It was meant as a compliment. That black trooper understood. He not only liked it, he was proud of it. I interviewed some old Kiowa and Comanche Indians in Anadarko, Oklahoma. And I asked several of them about the origin of the term Buffalo, so they confirmed what I just told them. And said, well, they were fighters.
In later years, the cavalrymen adopted the animal as part of their regimental insignia. They were officially Buffalo Soldiers. The area on which this magnificent monument stands was not a random choice. Much deeper significance was involved in the final selection. This is sculptor Eddie Dixon.
The original site was a parade ground. I spoke with an elderly woman that lived in the Fort Leavenworth area, that she was a reservoir of history. The area that she thought the soldiers should be placed was in an area near the river. In the earlier part of the history of Fort Leavenworth, this area was very small. Like it was a fog area. And the black soldiers weren't allowed to live up on the higher grounds or in the barracks in which they built for the white soldiers. And she stated that many soldiers died down there, many soldiers became very ill. And I selected that site because I thought the key word to everything that she had given me, I thought the key to it was the souls of those men are still there. So what would be a better site to place this sculpture than where the souls were still restless, moving around? So now I think they will be at ease and at rest.
While Grierson and the 10th handled the plains, Colonel Hatch and the 9th Cavalry were ordered to Texas. Indians, Comancheros, rustlers, and Mexican bandits were their foes. Sun, sand, and scorpions, their daily companions. And like the 10th, the 9th Cavalrymen had one more enemy, prejudice, by the very people they were risking their lives to defend.
In those days, Texans didn't take kindly to Yanks in uniform. And that went double for blue suits on black troopers.
The notes of towns that developed around these military folks. A black trooper didn't have to look for trouble. When he went to town, it was waiting.
In 1877, one such incident occurred outside Fort Concho in the rough and tumble town of San Angelo, now San Angelo, Texas. A group of cowboys and hunters confronted a sergeant, cut off his chevrons, the stripes from his trousers, and generally humiliated him. Back at the barracks, troopers hearing the story grabbed their weapons and headed back to the saloon. A massive shootout ensued, killing one Buffalo soldier and one of the townspeople. There were reprisals, but the cavalry troopers had made their point. That scene would be repeated many times in the frontier world of the troopers. An ironic footnote. In Indian territory, the 9th Cavalry was there to protect the five so-called civilized tribes against invasions by less domestic Indians. The five tribes were mainly successful farmers, aided greatly by their custom of keeping black slaves. These photographs constitute the largest single accumulation of Buffalo Soldier images ever assembled. The result of nearly 20 years of research by Dr. John Langelier, author and military historian. Many have never been published, and they are totally unique.
The fact is, these photographs took so long to assemble because they're scattered throughout the country in small historical societies and agencies and sometimes larger collections and private hands. They're extremely rare. The rarity comes from a number of factors, not the least of which is the fact that the soldiers themselves were stationed at remote outposts in many instances and had no access to photographers. In other cases, the soldiers had no real tradition of having their photographs taken. During the days of slavery, this was not an option that they had available to them. Cut off from family and friends in the past, the barracks became their home, their comrades, their family, or their adopted family, and thus there was no need to have a photo taken for that reason. Finally, these photos that do exist many times don't even have names associated with them. They're anonymous today, and yet they tell us so much. They are the only documents we have. Unlike other time periods, say the Civil War or even the Spanish-American War, we have a number of letters and even diary accounts from black troops who had served in those engagements. Nothing has survived from the enlisted men's point of view, written by the soldiers themselves, that we can really piece together and get an individual idea of who they are. We also will find that within these photographs, the soldiers themselves were proving something, not to themselves. They had no reason to do that. They knew they were professionals serving faithfully and with valor, and they didn't have to prove that to their comrades either. And yet they had a certain sense that somehow seems to come through when we look at these individual images of the men that said, we know who we are. We want others to know, not only other African Americans, but the nation as a whole, to know that we are proud soldiers, that we are capable professionals. That's what those photographs tell us. That's why they're so important to us, and that's unfortunately why they're so rare.
A detailed exploration of the black military experience on the frontier is difficult, but Fort Davis, Texas provides a microcosm, an isolated universe, one of the many homes of the Buffalo Soldiers. At varying times, both regiments of cavalry and the infantry operated from Fort Davis. And while the cavalry spent most of its time in pursuit of marauding Apaches, Comanches, Comancheros, and bandits, to the infantry fell the less glamorous jobs. Staffing the garrison, maintaining roads, guarding the stagecoach line, erecting the telegraph systems. More than 100 years later, mute evidence of their passing remains. The ruts of the Butterfield stage still mark the desert landscape. Stumps of telegraph poles placed by the black troopers jut from the sand. And at this important waterhole, the Tinaja de las Palmas, a battle which helped end the Apache Wars in Texas took place. Digging into the sand above these rock tanks sometimes produced enough water to stay alive. Convinced that Victorio and his warriors would cross the Rio Grande for yet another murderous raid, Colonel Grierson set a trap. His troopers spread dangerously thin by constant patrols. Grierson stationed guards at every waterhole 30 to 50 miles apart. Here in the shadow of the Eagle Mountains, Grierson, his teenage son, and 9 men of the 10th Cavalry waited and watched. Victoria, with nearly 100 warriors now desperate for water, entered the valley. Alarmed by the numbers, Grierson sent for reinforcements, and the battle was joined. The stone barricades erected by the troopers still stand exactly as they were in 1882. Fred Moore, a local rancher and historian, discovered the battle site some years ago.
I picked up about 3 or 4 spent cartridges in this area along the wall here, and I found one charged live cartridge that hadn't been fired at 4570, so apparently they were held up here, but they didn't do too much firing from this angle because they're 300 to 400 yards over there before the Indians were ported up on that little peak over there. Now, I did find quite a few empty fence shells along that bridge over there. And I presume they were from the Indians, according to Grierson's report was when the Indians spied Grierson and his troops up here on the hill while they turned south to try to miss the troops and go south of the state line, and that's when the troopers took after them over there, and the Indians forced up on that ridge over there, so that accounts for the spent shells over there, I'm sure. And, as I said, that's the only ones that I found here. And then on the point up there where Grierson actually was on top, I didn't find anything up there in the way of ammunition or shells or anything. So apparently they didn't fire from up there on account of the distance.
After several hours, Victoria retreated north to Rattlesnake Springs, where another Buffalo contingent lay in wait. The Apaches were forced back into Mexico, where the war chief was killed in a battle with the Federales. The Apache threat to southwest Texas was over. The United States Military Academy, West Point, New York. The grim expressions on the faces of these cadets are the kind that greeted new cadet Henry O. Flipper when he arrived. Flipper, the first black American ever to graduate from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, was a symbol to the entire black population.
He was from Atlanta, and his folks were ex-slaves. When Flipper graduated from West Point in 1877, he was our Jackie Robinson, Joe Louis, and Ralph Bunch all rolled into one. He took the silent treatment at school for 4 years and made it. He proved that we could do it, that we were just like everybody else.
It lasted 5 years. At Fort Davis, Flipper was accused of embezzling regimental funds. Contemporary reports suggest that his biggest crime was going riding with a white lady from the nearby town. Unlike accused white officers who were always confined to their quarters, Flipper was locked up in his guardhouse. The court-martial took place here in the post chapel. These are the ruins of the post chapel today. This is how it appeared during the court-martial. The verdict was guilty of conduct unbecoming an officer, and Flipper was given a dishonorable discharge, an excessive sentence, which for white officers usually brought a brief suspension and loss of pay. Flipper would devote the rest of his life in attempting to overturn the court.
Then, just a few years later, another man made it to West Point. John Hanks Alexander of Arkansas, whose parents had also been slaves, graduated in the class of 1887. Duty with the 9th Cavalry. Then, while assigned to Wilberforce University, he died of heart disease.
In all, only 3 black Americans in the 19th century graduated from West Point. Charles Young, whose family had moved north from Kentucky after the Civil War, was an outstanding student. He graduated in the class of 1889.
When he was still with the 9th, Lieutenant Young volunteered to tutor an ambitious sergeant who wanted to earn a commission. He got that commission and then some. That sergeant was Benjamin O. Davis, Sr. In 1940, he was the first black soldier ever to wear the star of a general.
And that family's tradition continued. In 1936, Benjamin O. Davis, Jr. became the first black graduate of West Point in more than 50 years, following the very man who had tutored his father. Davis, Jr., one of World War II's famous Tuskegee Airmen, retired from the U.S. Air Force in 1970, a lieutenant general. Unique to the Buffalo Soldier Regiments was the appointment of a regimental chaplain. In addition to their spiritual duties, the education of the troops, many of whom were illiterate, was a primary function. In 1884, Henry V. Plummer became the first black chaplain in the regular army. His assignment? Fort Riley, Kansas, the 9th Cavalry. Within a few years, he had established himself as a role model to the troopers. But, like Lieutenant Flipper before him, he fell victim to prejudice. He was court-martialed and dismissed from the army. One of the charges? Fraternizing with enlisted men. In 1886, Alan Allensworth, a Civil War veteran who was a slave and taught himself the forbidden arts of reading and writing, became the second black chaplain. He would spend the next 2 decades with the black troopers as one of the Army's most innovative and devoted educators. At Fort Byard, New Mexico, Allensworth wrote a manual which was to set the standard course of studies for the common soldier throughout the Army. His success led to the appointment of 3 more black chaplains, William T. Anderson, Theophilus G. Stewart, and George W. Prolong. Allensworth retired in 1906 as a lieutenant colonel, the highest ranking black officer of his day. Formal education was important, but fighting was the primary duty of the Buffalo Soldiers. Dr. Monroe Billington, author of New Mexico's Buffalo Soldiers.
In the years following the Civil War, the territory of New Mexico had 16 military installations. At 11 of those, black soldiers served at one time or another between 1866 and 1900. Those men were out here for a specific purpose. Their primary job was to pacify the Indians, to make New Mexico Territory a place to live in, safe for whites and Hispanics and other peoples who wanted to come out to this country. And while there were some white soldiers in New Mexico as well as blacks, there's no question that the blacks made a significant contribution in this area. Pacification of the Indians, their number one goal. And they spent a great deal of time working at that, some of them losing their lives, others spending time doing other things when they were not chasing Indians, but to help the others do their jobs. And in that regard, these soldiers made a significant contribution to the settlement of New Mexico. The black soldiers in New Mexico were not only interested in the Indians, nor was all the violence with which they were associated, did it have to do with the Indians. The army was also used for pacifying civil disturbances, as well as the Indians.
And it turns out that the black soldiers in New Mexico played an important role in New Mexico's most famous series of events. That's the Lincoln County War in the late 1870s. And the black soldiers were brought in by the colonel at Fort Stanton near Lincoln, New Mexico. And there, by coming down on one side or the other, he was able to bring the Lincoln County War to an end. Most people know that he played a role in it. They do not know that black soldiers were those who backed him up. And so the black soldiers played a role in pacifying New Mexico for in purposes of the white population as well.
The 9th Cavalry was making itself known in New Mexico. This badly faded tintype is our only link with this historic moment.
Sergeant Thomas Shaw from Covington, Kentucky. For meritorious courage under fire. The highest decoration the country could award. The Medal of Honor.
No pictorial record remains to show Sergeant George Jordan from Williamson County, Tennessee, in the same action with Shaw,
the Medal of Honor.
Sergeant John Denny from Big Flats, New York, Los Animas Canyon, New Mexico, 1879, for removing a wounded comrade to a place of safety while under heavy fire, the Medal of Honor. Sergeant Brent Woods, a farmer from Pulaski County, Kentucky, in Gavilan Canyon, New Mexico, the Medal of Honor.
The cavalry and some civilians were trapped. Their officer was killed. Old Woods took command. They said it was his energy and skill that defeated the Indians and saved the detachment from a massacre. He was some soldier. But then he got busted down to private. But they never did try to take that Medal of Honor.
The 24th and 25th Infantry would spend 11 years in the frontier wilderness of Texas, stretched thin along a border hundreds of miles long. Forts Davis, Stockton, Quitman, McCabot, and Clark. They built the roads, the forts, the telegraph lines, guarded wagon trains, and stagecoaches. In the early years, the 9th Cavalry would join them at Davis and Stockton. This was raw, remote, violent land, a threshold of American civilization. Indians, bandits, and Mexican revolutionaries raided, robbed, and murdered almost at will. The Buffalo Soldiers were the settlers' only hope for protection. The 10th Cavalry began its history in Kansas. Organized at Fort Leavenworth, they would spread across the plains at Fort Harker, Fort Hays, Fort Larned. Their war was a different one. Marauding Cheyenne and Kiowa, considered by many officers to be the finest light cavalry in the world, were the masters of the plains. The ill-equipped and hastily trained Buffalo Soldiers would prove to be their equal and more. One of the most valued documents of the Buffalo Soldier period is the journal kept by Sergeant Horace Bibbins, shown here with his dog Booth. The son of a farmer in Virginia, Bibbins attended Hampton School, and quoting his journal, "Having a very great desire for adventure and to see the Wild West, I joined the United States Army. Assignment, the 10th Cavalry, Fort Grant, Arizona Territory, and his final station, Fort Apache." The Indian War in the Southwest was nearly over, but Bibbins still had his taste of adventure. Chasing hostiles, patrolling roads and reservations, and protecting settlers was a full-time job. Bibbins West was still wild. His interest in marksmanship led to his eventual reputation as one of the best shots in the Army, and the medals on his uniform attest to his skill. An officer of the 10th wrote to Washington requesting a better duty station for the regiment after nearly 20 years in the desert. He suggested somewhere closer to civilization, like Kansas. And the regiment was transferred to Montana. They arrived during a blizzard at 20 below zero. They would remain there until the war with Spain. The 9th Cavalry would also be transferred to the Northern Plains. In 1890, patrols from the 9th were searching for Chief Bigfoot and his band of Sioux when the 7th Cavalry encountered them at Wounded Knee. The day after that battle, the 7th was trapped by another band of warriors. Outnumbered and facing annihilation, they sent for help. A forced march of over 100 miles in a single day brought the 9th Cavalry to the rescue. Custer's former regiment, saved by the very men he had declined to serve with, the Buffalo Soldiers. That battle earned the final Medal of Honor for the 9th Cavalry, It went to Corporal William O. Wilson for bravery. During their years on the frontier, 12 men of the 9th earned the coveted medal. And sadly, no pictures exist for most of them. Sergeant Emmanuel Stanks, Corporal Clinton Greaves, Sergeant Thomas Boyne, Sergeant John Denny, Sergeant George Jordan, Sergeant Henry Johnson, Sergeant Thomas Shaw, First Sergeant Moses Williams, Sergeant Brent Woods, Sergeant William McBriar, Corporal William O. Wilson, Private Augustus Wallen. The last man on this list, Augustus Wally, was one of the first Buffalo soldiers. He retired after 30 years of combat service. At the start of World War I, when the romance of the frontier had faded, this Indian fighter and winner of the Medal of Honor was recalled into the Army and promoted to first sergeant of a sanitation battalion in Louisiana. In 1889, two members of the 24th Infantry would join the Medal of Honor list. While escorting the paymaster in eastern Arizona, Sergeant Benjamin Brown and Corporal Isaiah May, wounded and outnumbered by bandits, responded in the highest traditions of the service, the Medal of Honor. The battleship Maine anchored in the harbor at Havana, Cuba, to protect American interests during Cuba's rebellion against Spanish rule. On February 15, 1898, a massive explosion rocked the ship, and it went to the bottom with 266 members of its crew. Hastily blaming the incident on Spain, America declares war. For the first time, all four black regular army units will be together. The troops are transported to Chickamauga Park, Georgia, then to Tampa, Florida for embarkation. Having spent all their years on the frontier, the Jim Crow laws they encountered in the South came as a terrible shock. Sergeant Horace Bivens, 10th Cavalry, quoting again from his journal. We left Fort Assiniboine, Montana by train. We received great ovations all along the line. As we neared the South, the great demonstrations became less fervent. Some station waiting rooms read, "White waiting room only." It was a revelation to us. Lieutenant John J. Pershing, 10th Cavalry, was witness to the ugly incidents, the beatings, shootings, and near riots, the Wilderness Warriors' reintroduction to civilized society.
Jim Crow took full force in 1890. Was so many that I would say black people suffered more during the 90s and in the first 10, 15 years of the 20th century than at least they had suffered after the Civil War or just prior to the Civil War. It was a bad time. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in 1910. That's not a coincidence.
Their training was brief and available transport was in short supply. The horses must be left behind. The cavalry would fight on foot in Cuba. The forts of Siboney and Daiquiri are chosen for troop landings. Their target, the city of Santiago. This film was taken by Thomas Edison's company as they landed. This authentic footage shows the 24th Infantry marching on Santiago. It was called the Splendid Little War, perhaps only by Theodore Roosevelt and his first volunteer cavalry, his Rough Riders. The first skirmish took place soon after landing at a place called Las Guasimas. The 10th Cavalry and the Rough Riders made short work of it. The next objective, the town of El Caney, 3 miles from Santiago. Pinned down by heavy fire, the 71st New York refuses to advance. Behind them, units of the 24th and 25th Infantry, Buffalo soldiers, and eager, surge past the 71st. The town falls in a fierce battle. By now, units are mixed and intermingled. Santiago is surrounded by a long, high ridge. The highest points on the ridge, some 150 feet high and ringed with blockhouses and barbed wire, are called Kettle Hill and San Juan Hill. Everyone fights bravely, but when the flag is planted on San Juan, it is planted by Sergeant George Berry of the 10th Cavalry. He also planted the flag of the 3rd, which he took from its wounded bearer on the way up. In the assault, the Rough Riders were flanked by the 9th and 10th Cavalry. Contemporary newspapers gave much of the credit to the Buffalo soldiers. So did Roosevelt, and told reporters, "I'll have much to say about that later," and he did. When he was running for office, Roosevelt said he had to force the black troopers up at gunpoint. Roosevelt was elected governor of New York as a result of San Juan Hill. 6 members of the 10th Cavalry were elected to join the ranks of winners of the Medal of Honor. Private Dennis Bell, Private Fitz Lee, Private William H. Hopkins, Private George H. Walton, Sergeant Major Edward L. Baker, Private Charles Cantrell. During the fighting, an epidemic of yellow fever ravaged the troops. Hospital volunteers were called for. To a man, the 24th Infantry volunteered, and many of them fell sick and died along with the men they were treating. A famous sketch of the time shows Sergeant Bivens' dog Booth mourning over the dead body of a friend.
Got this note from a buddy of mine, old Carter, long time ago. Been carrying it in my pocket ever since. Let me read it to you. First Sergeant Carter Smith, 10th Cavalry. I noticed that both white and colored soldiers had a brotherly affection for each other while on the way to Cuba. In Cuba, and on the way back to the United States. They got along nicely together. During the whole campaign, I never heard a cross word pass between them. Why can't it be so at home? Maybe tomorrow.
The 19th century was at a close, as were the wars on the Western frontier. And so, too, was the 30-year legend of the Buffalo Soldier. In Indian Territory, soon to become the state of Oklahoma, they protected the resident tribes. They also built Fort Sill. These photographs show Colonel Grierson and his troopers surveying Medicine Bluff outside the fort. They drove out the Boomers, bands of settlers who for years tried to illegally invade the territory. In the desert heat of the Southwest, they fought their way along the trails that are now major highways and made those states safe for settlement. In later years, as the fighting gradually subsided, there was time for recreation. Hunting was useful both as a sport and as a way to improve the regimental diet. Intercompany sports such as the tug of war were popular. And since Abner Doubleday was briefly commanding officer of the 10th Cavalry, perhaps that explains the troop interest in the sport of baseball. Football was also gaining great acceptance. And although not strictly a sport, as shown here in 1896 at Yellowstone Park, the troopers experimented with bicycles as a possible means of troop transport. In civilian life, Colonel Grierson was once a music teacher. Searching out the raw talent in his 10th Cavalry, Grierson arranged to buy instruments, taught the men, formed a regimental band. Both the officers and the men contributed to the funding of the band. Not only a morale booster for the men, concert appearances and holiday parades in towns outside the forts helped the troops gain popularity with the civilians. July 25th, 1992, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Commander Colton Philpott, United States Navy, the man who led the 10-year drive to complete the memorial, presents it officially to the Army.
I want you and the rest of the world to know this is not a one-person project. It is not a Leavenworth project. It is a national project that we are turning over to you, the Army, to maintain and upkeep with tender, loving care, sir.
As you look at the sculpture and as you look at the piece, please see within that
that we were trying to symbolize here. I would like it to be a new beginning for the generations coming up. And oftentimes they tell you, the new generation, that this is an era of cynicism. But don't believe them, because the light at the end of the tunnel is a new dawn rising. And your generation is that new dawn. And the greatest legacy we can leave to you at this time is a tangible reference point, that you can see that you are a part of this. You are a part of the development of America. And no one race or group did this, but we all did it together.
In honor of the day, the 302nd Fighter Squadron, the unit of the Tuskegee Airmen of World War II. And a salute to the man who dreamed more than 10 years ago that a moment like this could become a reality. The highest-ranking military officer in the United States, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Colin Powell. The general reads from Gerson's farewell letter to his troops.
The officers and enlisted men have cheerfully endured many hardships and privations, and in the midst of great dangers, steadfastly maintained the most gallant and zealous devotion to duty. And they may well be proud of the record made, and rest assured that the hard work undergone and the accomplishment of such important and valuable service to their country cannot fail sooner or later to meet with due recognition and reward. Benjamin H. Gerson, Colonel, 10th United States Cavalry. And now, 104 years later, July 25th, 1992, his dream, the recognition and reward, has finally come true. And so has my dream. Beginning with the Buffalo Soldiers in 1866, African Americans would henceforth always be in uniform, challenging the conscience of a nation, posing the question of how could they be allowed to defend the cause of freedom, to defend the nation, if they themselves were to be denied the benefits of being Americans. The great liberator Frederick Douglass made the same point. Douglass said, "Once let the black man get upon his person the brass letters U.S., let him get an eagle on his button and a musket on his shoulder and bullets in his pocket, and there is no power on earth which can deny that he has earned the right to citizenship in the United States of America." So look at this statue. Look at him. Imagine him in his coat of blue, on his horse, a soldier of the nation, eagles on his buttons, cross sabers on his canteen, a rifle in his hand, a pistol on his hip, courageous, iron-willed. He was every bit the soldier that his white brother was. He showed that the theory of inequality must be wrong. He could not be denied his right. It might take time. It did take time. But he knew that in the end, he could not be denied. The Buffalo Soldiers were not the only ones in the struggle. The 24th and the 25th Infantry Regiments, the 92nd and 93rd Infantry Divisions, the high-flying Tuskegee Airmen, the parachuting Triple Nickels, our Navy's Golden 13, the Munford Point Marines, and thousands of other brave black Americans have gone in harm's way for their country since the days of the Buffalo Soldier, always moving forward and upward, step by step, sacrifice by sacrifice. But we are not here today to criticize an America of 150 years ago, but to rejoice. To rejoice that we live in a country that has permitted a spiritual descendant of the Buffalo Soldier to stand before you today as the first African-American chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Well, you had an opportunity to hear about the Buffalo Soldiers and those who came after them. That was a documentary that was done in 1992, and of course Colin Powell was the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that particular time, a black general. You have been listening to Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean, on Memorial Day, celebrating not only the black soldiers, but those who have given their lives for our country. Have a good day, and hopefully you'll tune in again on Friday. Good day.